You're watching The Sports Objective, the podcast for Pirates. You're listening to Absolute Empowerment with Coach Jeff Connors on The Sports Objective. Join Coach C, a USA Strength and Conditioning Hall of Famer, every Monday night to see in a variety of guests, including former players, former and current coaches, pastors, and others will discuss relevant issues in coaching today's athlete, with the goal of equipping the athlete and those coaching them with the physical, mental, and spiritual armor necessary to live their best life. Here's Coach Connors.
Welcome to Absolute Empowerment, coming to you from Nashville, Tennessee. Tonight we have a very special guest, Coach Steve Watterson. Coach Watterson was the longest strength and conditioning coach in the NFL. So he stayed with one franchise for 32 years, and that was the Houston Oilers and Tennessee Titans. Steve was with the Philadelphia Eagles initially. He came to the Houston Oilers in 1986 to 1990 with Jerry Glanville. Then Jack Pardee from 1990 to 94, and Jeff Fisher from 1994 to 2010, and then Mike Munchak from 2011 to 2013. And Coach, I hope that's all correct, but we are certainly glad to have you on the show.
Yep. I also worked with Coach Wisenhunt, who took over after Munchak, and then Coach Malarkey.
Okay.
Good men. And then ended my run when Coach Vrabel took over. I just knew it was time to retire.
Right.
Knew the body wasn't, couldn't do it.
And the total number of years with that franchise was 32 or 35 or?
Well, 32 with, it started my 33 with the Oilers / Titans. And, but actually started 84 and 85 with the Eagles. And then I started my internship with them, Eagles, back in 78. So I'm aging myself.
Right. Well, you know, I want to say that Coach was one of my mentors, and I really believe that there's no one smarter than Steve Watterson in relationship to strength and conditioning. And I certainly learned a lot from him, and he helped me in my career. And I'm just really happy to be able to have him on the show. And as we've done with many other guests on the show, we want to have highly accomplished people on here to tell a little bit about their story and also any testimony throughout their lives, things that they've overcome through faith. And I think probably anybody who's been in coaching has got a few of those types of things to talk about. So tonight we want to talk about the Steve Watterson story and talk about a little bit first about the young Steve Watterson before he ended up somehow with the Philadelphia Eagles, starting his career there. So, Coach, let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, I guess if I had to give a theme to my story, it would be adapt or die, or if you don't adapt, you may be left high and dry, because I certainly didn't ever expect to be sitting here with you talking about my career in the NFL or in strength and conditioning. I started out Newport, Rhode Island, right on the ocean, and my whole goal in life, all the way till my junior year in college, was to be the next Jacques Cousteau. I planned on being in the ocean, studying the ecosystems, taking a look at interactions between different animal families. And it wasn't until my junior year that things went a little bit awry, because I found out that with an incorrectable blind in one eye, that I would basically be a land-based researcher. And I started looking for an alternative career. And I was blessed, because I was really intrigued on athletic training, sports medicine, how you handle athletes. I was an athlete through high school and college, but I wasn't a very good athlete. but I was always interested in how the body worked. I guess it goes back to my love for the sciences. And so to think that I'm sitting here today and looking back at a career that had to do in a sport that I never played. I never played football. And yet my whole career was working and training athletes to be the best they could be.
Right. Now, you became certified as an ATC, correct, at some point?
I did.
Athletic trainer. And when was that and how did that occur?
Well, as I said, in junior year in college, I went down and talked to people at the athletic training room at the University of Rhode Island. Met a great man named Tom Dolan. He loved my passion. I kind of came at things probably a little different from a high science point of view. And so I'm thankful they didn't find my questions tiresome, but I would question methodology. Why do you do this? Why is this? How does the body work? This is what I know about cells in the body. And so that summer, I was very fortunate. He put my name in for an internship with Philadelphia Eagles because he himself had worked as an assistant athletic trainer with the St. Louis Cardinals way mm-hmm. back then. And I was able to get an internship and worked with a great staff. And one of my mentors, Ronnie O'Neill, still to this day, we talk and talk professionally about what goes on in the profession. And he took me under his wing and really showed me how to look at things from a distance. You know, one of the great things that he taught me, one of the greatest things is, Steve, no matter how hard you work, don't think that you'll heal anything. God heals. It's our job to put it in the best position to heal, whether it be immobilizing, whether it be using modalities with heat or ice or electric modalities, those things put it in the right environment. But the actual healing of tissue, that's God's. Mm.
So in relationship to what you learned with regard to that educational experience and becoming an athletic trainer, how did you feel like that information gave you, let's say, somewhat of a foundation for strength and conditioning and performance training prescription? What was the advantage there you think you may have gained?
Well, let's go back to the histrionics a little bit about the profession. You know, when I came in to the NFL, a lot of the strength coaches were still kind of coaches in waiting, wannabe coaches. They were coaching another, they wanted to coach a position. And there wasn't a position available. So sometimes a coach would say, okay, I'm going to have you run the weight room until a position opens up for you. There were some really great, impactful, they influenced me, strength coaches when I did come in, like, say, a Bob Ward.
Yeah.
I mean, a Virgil Knight. I mean, there were some really good strength coaches. But for the most part, they came out of the field of physical education or, like I mentioned, in coaching. The men I mentioned were more of kinesiologists.
Yeah.
In biomechanics. I was an exercise physiologist. And so when I came in, I came from a vantage point of how the body works, how cell works, how healing works. And so I think a lot of my background in athletic training really, really did help me and set the platform, allowing me to really learn from a lot of great people. Do you remember
right.
Tim Jorgensen?
Yes.
Tim Jorgensen, strength coach, LSU, incredible man, really helped me understand the applications and understand how to build periodicity programs that worked in cycles. And learning from him helped catapult me to wanting to work in the profession. And so a coach that I had worked with, and this is the great thing about, hopefully you'll hear today, is it's so much about relationships. I worked for the Eagles, and I worked and I helped Ron Jaworski get back on the field after he had that terrible ankle fracture. They never thought he'd play again. And because of my work with him, the wide receiver coach named Milt Jackson, who I got to work with a couple years, left to go to the Houston Oilers. And when Jerry Glanville took over the job at the Houston Oilers, Milt says, "Hey, I got the guy for you, Jerry, because you, Jerry wanted someone that not just did strength conditioning, but it would also get guys back on the field faster. He was very concerned with the rehab process as well.
Right.
He believed healthy athletes, your best athletes that are healthy, help you win the most games. And so he reached out, and that began my career in strength and conditioning with the Oilers back in 1986.
Just going back to the Eagles, I just want to mention, you know, I was very fortunate that Coach John Bunning hired me at UNC Chapel Hill. And I love Coach Bunning. And, of course, I think he was playing with the Eagles when you were there. So just want to mention Coach Bunning and see if you maybe had a story or two about Coach Bunning.
JB, if you're watching this, I'm going to tell stories about you cramping up at training camp. Oh, my gosh. I'm telling you, that linebacker corps that John Bunning played with, I mean, you think about Frank LeMaster.
Oh, yeah.
Bill Berge. Oh, my gosh. Right? Yeah. I mean, these guys were men. And so JB was one of the stalwart players on that Eagles team. And I still remember at training camp, him coming in and just flying through the qualifying test, the fitness test, which were the 16 120s.
Okay.
And you had to do it with your pulse recovery. And I'm talking about he worked.
What year was that?
This would have been 1978.
Okay.
Sorry if I'm aging you, JB.
Yeah.
And all I remember was, I believe it was the next day or the day after, really, really hot day. And I think we're at Widener University, and JB wouldn't come out. A couple guys were injured, and he was practicing. And I've never seen someone cramp up to such a degree that we could not break the spasm in his forearms or his biceps. We actually had to carry him in, submerge him in ice water, inject him to have muscle relaxers because he was in such rigidity. I mean, it was incredible pain that he was in. Yet, as a JB fashion, you knew he was there the next day.
Oh, yeah.
He didn't take any time off. But that was a different era for the for the athletes. That's when it was truly about as much about toughness as it was about athletic ability. JB just happened to have both.
Right. Well, I was just so fortunate because I was also able to meet a few of his teammates who had come to a few of our games. And the guy that I remember the most was Luigi Amona. And I think Luigi lives in Key West now, but definitely one of the most enthusiastic, intense individuals I've ever met who seemed to like to have a good time. As well. So I'm sure you remember Louis G.
I do. I had a very brief interaction with Louis because obviously I when they went to the Super Bowl, I was asked to come back and work. I was still in school. I was working on my master's degree at that time. And so I was invited back. And for some reason, a few of the guys had pointed me out because I used to sing at training camp. and JP would like to get me up on the table, as well as a few of the other guys. Ron Jaworski would have me serenade at dinner at training camp. And so I had not met Louis up to that point, but I remember a few of the guys saying, this is the guy we were telling you about that would sit. And so I'm all nervous because I'm a college student and I'm sitting there at the dining room table, and I'm sitting there with Marion Campbell and Dick Vermeil and Les Stiles, and Dick Corey. And the head athletic trainer and the assistant trainer, Ron O'Neill, who ultimately was one of my biggest mentors, taught me so much. I wouldn't be here today without him. But I'm sitting there at dinner, and all of a sudden, I feel something hit me in the head like a rock. And I am trying to keep my composure, and I'm reaching up into my side of my ear, and I pull out a pimento. And it was Louis had hit me in the head with an olive at dinner. So that was my interaction.
Why does that not surprise me?
Oh, my gosh. You know, the unknown, often overlooked fact is, did you know Louis was Dick Vermeil's nephew?
I did know that. Coach Bunning let us know that.
Oh, yeah. Well, he never let that affect the relationships because he was as tough for Dick to handle as probably any athlete.
I believe it. With Coach Vermeil coming in there, you know, what do you remember about, you know, what did he do to change things, or what were some of his stronger points that you think made him so successful?
Well, you know, I came in, let's see, 78. So that was the year of anybody who's a movie buff, the movie Invincible. That was the year that I came to work as an intern. Now, Dick had been there, obviously, for a couple of years. What I can tell you about Dick is something I learned from my parents, but I saw in Dick. You were not going to outwork him.
Right.
As an intern, we had a little cubby hole where we would stay sleeping right in Vet Stadium, little side room, and we would hear, no matter what time in the morning we had to get up, it's usually about 5:30 to start preparing for camp, and then didn't get done till 11:30 because bed check started at 11. By the time you were done, it was 11:30. And yet we'd still hear 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning. Film.
Okay.
The old,
yeah, the old film.
The old 12 millimeter film. Yeah. And Dick would be, because he believed that he was not going to be outworked. He was not going to let anything slide under the table that he missed. And that started with training camp practices. He wanted to know everything about everybody's ability and what they did and anything they possibly missed or something that he had to adjust. Work was never going to be the reason that something was missed.
Right.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Which goes into actually something that, as I said, I got to see in Dick, but I had learned that lesson about work ethic from my dad. You know, my family, I have four brothers and sisters, nurses. My brother was a Marine, a very successful teacher, highly respected in their fields. And my old man only went through high school. My mother was a very accomplished teacher and highly educated. But I can remember being in family discussions and my dad sitting back, and you couldn't outwork my dad. He was one of the, to this day, hardest working men I've ever known. And I can remember my dad telling me one time when I came back and thinking I was feeling pretty good about my grades or my status, graduating and my class ranking. And I can remember my dad looking at me and saying, son, better be prepared for this. There's always going to be somebody smarter.
Right.
And there's always going to be somebody tougher. There's always going to be somebody faster. But it's your choice to let somebody outwork you.
Right.
Never let that be the reason for failure.
Now, who was it that influenced you the most with regard to your spiritual life?
Well, there's been several people along the way. I've been very blessed. My family, the basis from my parents, always... Every one of the children, we all realized that Jesus Christ was our Lord and Savior. That was never a question. That's not something that we had to acquire. Unfortunately, personality-wise and being a young, rambunctious young man, it took me a while sometimes to realize the value of what I was being taught.
Yeah.
And so even going to the Eagles, getting involved with the team, learning professionally from Ron O'Neill. He was also a very good spiritual mentor, talking to me about the important things of life. As I mentioned, Ron taught me that we don't heal, even in the field of sports medicine. We don't heal things.
Right.
God heals. We put things in the best position to heal, whether we immobilize or use ice or heat or a modality. We use medications. But that's not what heals.
Right.
That puts tissue in the best position to heal, but it's God's healing in God's time. And that was a really important message, because too many times I think we think that we're God, we play God, and that we're responsible for certain things. No, we're responsible to put the body and help athletes get into the best possible position so they can optimize what they've been, the gifts they've been given.
Right.
So that would be another mentor. Another great mentor was a coach on our staff, Sherman Smith, great running back that played for the 49ers. And at Bible studies, staff studies, his ability to make scripture practical in our lives. I remember one of his favorite scriptures, which was over my weight room door, since he taught me the value of iron sharpens iron.
Yes, sir. You know,
Proverbs is very clear that how one man hones another man's abilities, even in their walk with Jesus Christ.
No question.
And so I'm very appreciative to Sherm Smith. And what's crazy is you talk about the evolution of relationships. Two of the players I'm still very, very close to the point that we communicate every day. Not some days. Every day we move from verse to verse through the Bible. And that's two Hall of Famers, Mike Munchak, who became the head coach for the Titans. And Bruce Matthews, probably the greatest offensive lineman ever. He could play any position.
That's awesome.
Bruce has gone from being kind of a cynical, more sometimes an introvert, to his passion with his walk with the Lord, that he's actually one that leads our Bible study. Share scripture every day, and then every Monday we get together for a Zoom call and have an hour study just going everything that we've been sharing with, or actually going over a text from a book. And so I really do think that men need to reach out and search out peers, someone they admire, someone that is knowledge, and that they can challenge each other and hold each other accountable. Now, the term is an accountability partner. I think it is essential. And as far as the profession's concerned, I got to tell you, there's a guy that we have, I consider him my brother. We coached across the field for a lot of years. It's been over 25 years. He was on the other side of the field. Jerry Palmieri, an incredible human being, an incredibly knowledgeable and faithful man who writes scriptures and devotions and sends them out to a whole group of men every day. And Jerry, who coached Super Bowl teams, he was New York. Obviously, he was with the New Orleans Saints for a short period as assistant, Jacksonville Jaguars. But he has touched so many lives with how he's coached, just not what he knows, and being a really great strength coach, but as being a stalwart, strong Christian man, and really being a fine example of how a man is supposed to live today.
Well, I visited Jerry when he was with the Jaguars, and he was, shared everything with us, and we just had a great time with him that day. Of course, I learned some things from Jerry, and I definitely want to have him on the show in the future, because, you know, these are the types of things we're trying to do with Absolute Empowerment, no doubt about it. I think I told you that I had Kevin Colbert on, and Kevin had retired from the Steelers and decided to start Lend a Hand, which they're having about 30, 40 former Steelers on a Zoom call about once a month. And I know that the one that he had most recently when I talked to him was they talked about wills and trusts. And then he just kind of left it to them to interact with each other, maybe pray for each other, or see who might need a hand. And I was just so impressed with that, that I'm trying to start one myself with some of the former ECU athletes, or just about anybody else who wants to participate. And I'm calling it Locker Room for Life. We're going to try to get that kicked off later this coming week. I also wanted to, getting back to what we were talking about with regard to education. You know, I was at the National Strength and Conditioning Conference here recently to kind of get my CEUs and keep my master strength coach, even though I'm retired. I'm trying to, for whatever reason, trying to keep a certification, who knows. But when I was there, I had heard that they are going to require possibly in the future with these certifications that you have, let's say a master's degree in exercise phys, or at least maybe a bachelor's in exercise phys. And of course, with guys that came like me that came through many, many years ago, we didn't have exercise physiology. And I was a phys ed guy also. I think I have every certification known to mankind. But outside of that, what I wanted to ask you, because I think you're probably the most knowledgeable about this than anybody else, is optimally, what would you like to see in relationship to how strength coaches are educated, or even what their practical experiences, let's say, might bring to the table, or what practical experiences might be required, as well as education, to optimize the effectiveness of every strength and conditioning coach?
Well, there's a lot to be said for internships and for apprenticeships. Obviously, I went through an apprenticeship program, just being able to get to the Eagles back in 78. But I also believe that pure academics, pure knowledge is absolute. You have to have a certain amount of knowledge mixed with experience to really meet the needs of an athlete today. Yeah. So I've always been a big supporter that there should be a certification, even though I never went through that college strength coaches certification program because I was always in the pros.
Right.
But I do believe that accountability and staff should be held accountable for certain expectations and knowledge.
Yeah.
To be able to do what you are hired to do. So, yes. But on the other hand, I do think, I mean, I've learned so much from guys that I've met over the years that got into the profession and didn't have any formal training, even in, say, exercise physiology.
Yeah.
Old guys, whether it be someone that was a lifter like Clyde Embrick, amazing technician. Read the stories of Lou Ricci. I mean, these
Ricky
guys,
Rack.
Ricky Rack, take a look at some of the guys that have done it from a practical point of view. But I do believe the profession has progressed to the point that to have an expectation of a certification, maintaining CEUs.
Yeah.
This is the iron sharpens irons in the practical world.
Right.
That you really do have to challenge each other to be the best for the athletes. As a matter of fact, when I finally retired in 18, I actually went to the owner and said, I knew it was time to leave. And I reiterated a statement I told the media in 1993 when I was doing an interview, and they said, how long do you want to still do this? And I said, I would like to do it until the very best that the athletes deserve is more than the very best that I can provide.
Gotcha.
And so with more knowledge, with more programs being available, just take a look at the technology that's available to the player state. When you started coaching, did you ever think you would be using tendo units?
I would not have had any idea what a tendo unit was, but I used them a lot.
You did. I know. And I've learned so much from you as far as how to apply them into the program. I mean, when we walked onto the field, when I started in this profession, you had a stopwatch.
Right.
And I knew a lot of guys that all they used it for was to swing it.
Yeah.
Not knowing that it actually was a way to quantify how fast someone was, how fast they could recover.
Yeah.
Mock the intervals, mock the repetitions. So yes, the profession has significantly changed, and the science end of it and the data collection is incredible.
Right.
But you know what? None of that will ever replace the ability to get athletes to work.
Right.
That's a quality that still has not been able to be really technically honed or measured in any college class.
No doubt about it. 100% agree with that. And I had a, just for the heck of it, I put some of my own questions together. In fact, I even put them on Facebook not too long ago, you know, with regard to this issue. I just had some of my own questions that I might ask just for the heck of it. Like, did you ever play football? Did you play in college? Have you ever run down on a kickoff and blown up a middle wedge? These are all things that I experienced. I was actually a wedge buster. I was number two on a kickoff team. I think another one was, do you know what it feels like to have 600 pounds on your back? Have you ever squatted three times your body weight? Have you ever trained like an animal for 12 weeks for a meet? Mm-hmm. What else? Have you ever trained three times a day because you wanted to win so bad, you thought extra training was going to help you, which you don't hear that much either now, but.
Oh, how about you train three or four times a day?
Yeah.
Because you wanted to work alongside the guys that you were training.
Yeah, there you go.
So they saw
you training.
And the effort that you expected and the demand.
That's right.
And I don't think that's quite the expectation, maybe as much today as it was in the old days. But, you know, I'm very cautious to throw out to the young guys, to the young men in the profession, because I really do admire where the profession is developing and where it's going. I think scientifically, the application of data, the ability to take out and extract things that we thought were important in the old days. I'm going to give you an example. Honesty is important in our profession. Yeah. And you have to admit when you did things wrong. Do you know the first test I used to give the players when they arrived back when they came back for training in March back in the old days? They ran a mile.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why would I have an offensive lineman run a mile? But
that was very common.
But that was what was the practice of the time.
Right.
We're way beyond that.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I do think that the ability to expect more out of the athletes sometimes has been compromised. I think the athletes want to be pushed. I think they push back against some of the testing and some of the protocols, but in reality, they really do want to know where they're at and where their standards are. And so the hard work will never, to me, ever take go by the wayside in lieu of science. They're hand in hand.
Right. Interesting. Well, I wanted to also ask you about some of the people you've worked for. I know you worked for Jerry Glanville, and of course, you know, you hear a lot of stories about Jerry Glanville, and I've known some other people that work for him. So, can you say a little bit about your experience working for him?
I don't know if you can work for a more fun guy. a guy who has passion for the game more than Jerry Glanville. Jerry is 81 going on 21. There's still no job that Jerry doesn't think that he should have or get, and he will still pursue at his age now. And you talk about someone that showed passion for every aspect of the game. There are still things that I can hear echo into eternity that he used to have as sayings. For example, if something wasn't done right on the field, I can see him going up, not to the player, but up to the coach and saying, are you coaching that or are you just going to let it happen? Because that's not right. And the minute the coach started trying to get out of it, he'd say, I expect a drill to fix that. He believed that nothing should not be corrected. Mm. On the other hand, he was an interesting character. He believed that, he taught me that I will never lose a child over a tattoo or an earring. He told me that there should only be so many lines drawn in the sand.
Yeah.
And those lines are in concrete. There are boundaries, but some people just need a little bigger backyard than others.
Gotcha.
And I'm talking about the amount of fun. He made it so that the unity of the team, he could change the culture of an organization in a heartbeat with just his passion for how he went about coaching.
Wow. That's awesome. Now, how about Jack Pardee?
Jack Pardee was one of the Junction Boys. You talk about a dry, stoic Texan. Jack Pardee was a man of few words, but when he spoke, they were important, and you better adhere to him. He was a great human being. I've been really blessed in that venue. I mean, the guys that I have worked for have been such good people. But Jack Pardee was as solid as a man, both as a player and a coach, as you could work for. I still remember Merlin Olsen coming to practice and then talking to a couple of us coaches on the sideline one day, and he was talking about Deacon Jones, and this is about the Redskins. And Merlin told us about Jack Pardee telling Merlin Jones. Merlin had a broken hand. He came out of the game, and Jack came out of the game when the offense went on. And he goes, what are you doing, Deacon? He goes, I broke my hand. He goes, I don't care. You get back in that game. He goes, even if you can't do anything, just you being out there means they're not going to run to that side. You find a way to get back on that field. Jack, like I say, lived out that Junction Boy reputation. He was hard-nosed. He was old school. He loved his guys. His one failure was he thought the young players that he was coaching loved the game with the passion that he loved it with when he played. Mm.
Interesting. I've known a few like that. So let's talk a little bit about Jeff Fisher. And I thought it was just pretty incredible, but not surprising to me that with him, you were named the associate head coach.
Yeah. He made me the assistant head coach. I think some of it had to do with the responsibilities of that went beyond just the strength and conditioning position. Yet, I would say that on most teams, the things that I was fortunate to have that title really is what most strength and conditioning coaches do on every team. I know what you had to do with your team. You held the players accountable. You tried to make sure that they were ready on every facet and aspect of the preparation, other than say the X's and O's. But having the mental aptitude to changing the mental attitude, to helping the players realize what was going to be expected of them falls on almost every strength coach of the programs that are worth a lick. And so Yeah, I was very fortunate. You know, it did lock me in. It made it, and I, like I say, I was very fortunate, very blessed to work with great men. Jeff obviously was not only a good man to work for, you know, he was personally a very good friend.
Right. Well, I think it's, I felt like I had a relationship like that with Steve Logan, for instance. You know, for 10 years I was with him, and, you know, you go through some great times, you go through some tough times, and, you know, I was, I don't know what I would have done for Steve. Probably would have stepped in front of him, you know, and taken, yeah, on a street somewhere if I saw he was going to get hit by a car or something. But that's how strongly I felt about him and felt about the program. And, you know, he did a lot for me. And when we talk about accountability and we talk about all those things that you're willing to fight for, you know, because you know they're so important. You know, my four things were accountability, work ethic, discipline, and spirit. And I believe that if you had those four things, you were going to be successful in anything you do in life. And that's why I never wanted to compromise any of those. So if you're 30 seconds late, you got to pay the price because you got to be accountable. Mm-hmm. There were times when people, if somebody didn't show up for a lift, we'd go to the dorm and go get them. You know, hey, we're coming to your house and get you, mm-hmm. you know, and, we expected people to be enthusiastic. I expected to be enthusiastic myself, you know, when I stepped in the door as a coach, because everybody's going to pretty much work off of, you know, whatever my attitude is for that day. But those four things, I'm never going to compromise them. I'll take them to the grave with me. And, you know, I survived 7 head coaches, which was an act of God itself. But at the same time, I really think the fact that I wouldn't compromise those things helped me. But then the times when I felt like I had to compromise one or two of those in some respect to keep a job, for instance, those were miserable times. Yeah. And, you know, you don't want to have to do that. So I guess just a few thoughts of my own on that topic.
No, and right along with that, you know, Jeff epitomized the expression, and for any coaches out there watching and listening, I think this is really an important adage, that people won't care about how much you know until they know how much you care.
Yeah.
And Jeff epitomized that expression. I mean, there's not a player that played for Jeff that didn't know how much he wanted the best for them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even players that maybe their time had run out with the team, or that player didn't fit maybe in our scheme. In leaving the team, Jeff would always lift the player up and try to make them realize, well, you know, it didn't work out here. Hopefully it'll work out with someone else. Always expressed appreciation for the effort given. So much of it probably had to do with, you know, him being an ex-player, a very successful yeah. player with Chicago Bears. The players knew that Jeff really cared. And I'm, like I said, I'm so fortunate for the coaches that I've worked with. I mean, going back to starting with Dick Vermeil.
Yeah.
There's nobody that played for him that didn't appreciate how much he loved them. And I'll go all the way up to, you know, with Munchak, Mike Mullaky. These head coaches, there's a reason why they become head coaches right. for the most part. I'm not saying everyone, but for the most part.
No doubt.
They have the respect.
No doubt.
Of the room.
Yeah.
And the players know that they have the best interest at heart.
Now, let me ask you this. Let's talk a little bit about your methodology. And maybe we can just mention how methodology has changed over the years, the evolution of methodology, and all the influences that we've seen and considered as part of our programs, or maybe not considered. And so, just generally speaking, strength training. Give me a few things.
Well, okay, let's go back to the era that we grew up in. There was really two factions, right? There yep. was the yep. High intensity, which were the circuit training, the machine guys.
Yep. Yep.
And I think that's looking back, I don't think that's really fair because their programs really did embody more. And there were the weightlifters.
Yep.
I'm going to go to either powerlifting or Olympic lifting.
Olympic lifting.
I came out of the powerlifting family.
Yeah.
So I believe it bar something from ground, from all the way from the ground to your nose. There had to be something in your hand, something that was moving. I also believe that your ability to adapt and to change and to take a look at what were meeting the needs of the athletes. As you know, I kind of pioneered, I would say, or my assistant really instigated, Jason Novak up at Michigan State, but I really fostered bringing back vintage training.
Yeah.
I hated the term that I was, or the kettlebell guy, but
yeah.
I used a lot of vintage tools, whether it be ropes, suspension, whether it be clubs, a mace, but a lot of kettlebell activities.
Right.
Because I felt it needed, it met the needs of the athletes that had to bring all of the explosive training into a more functional application, which carried out onto the field.
Yeah.
So as far as methodology, I'm going to have to quote, give you my nickname given to me by the very highly esteemed Bert Hill, Coach Bert Hill
for
both of us.
Yes, sir.
Bert used to call me Dr. Volume. He goes, God bless it, son. He goes, I don't know how you can do that many sets of that many reps in a workout. And I did learn, I will be honest with you, that I had to modify the amount of volume in a workout. And learning that from everybody from Westside Barbell to a lot of the Bulgarian and Russian styles of training, that volume wasn't always an athlete's best friend. And I did modify. But I would say if there was a fault in my program is that I would get the overtraining of the athletes, sometimes trying to get more work in.
Yes.
Instead of just getting the best quality work.
Been there myself. And I do want to mention the fact that I first learned kettlebells in your garage with you and your wife.
Yes, sir.
And it was a beating that I took that day, trying to catch my breath for an hour.
Well, it's funny because
a metabolic experience.
Yes. I still remember having a lot of the guys that I respect so much, the guys that get to wear the green jackets. I mean, the Masters, if you wear a Masters jacket, you've achieved something. Right. And it's something you've earned and deserved. But I remember having so many of the guys come in after that conference in Nashville, and so many guys came in and watched us train. And they all thought it was intriguing, but they didn't really see how it was going to fit and what the real benefits were going to be. And then you came up, visited me a couple of weeks later and said, you know, I really liked it. I'd like to know more about it, but I just don't see what the benefits were.
Right.
And then I remember coming, you spent some time with us at the weight room. You came and saw the players doing it. And you
found it. Spent some time with Anthony.
Yep. And then you stepped out in my garage with us.
Yeah.
I think the next day you ordered about $30,000 worth of kettlebells.
Yeah, we basically, we got about 30 pair of kettlebells in Carolina shortly after that. And
then we had them delivered.
Yeah.
At the Opryland Hotel for you.
Yeah, and then when we were in the Music City Bowl, I called you and said, hey, can you lend me some kettlebells to put in the hotel rooms up here? And, you know, the rooms that they gave us to train. And those guys didn't forget those workouts that week either because, you know, we were trying to get ready for that bowl game.
Yep.
You know, we ended up winning the game, but it was an extremely close game. Yeah, and I'm still a kettlebell guy for myself and anybody else that I train. I still love barbells.
Oh, yes.
I still love, you know, pretty much all the different tools that we've used over the years. But
it's just a tool.
Yeah.
Yep.
But it is a great tool. And the other thing, too, was, you know, I was involved with wrestlers a lot that was earlier in my career, but I was also a high school wrestling coach. But when I was at Carolina, I also trained a wrestling team for a couple of years. And so it was very effective training for those wrestlers as well. Yeah. Let's just mention speed development, which is something that, you know, you didn't hear much about. I first was introduced to it when I went down to the Eagles and spent time with Ronnie Jones. And he brought in Kevin McNair from out in California to work with the Eagles. And, of course, that's when Buddy was there. And not too long after that, actually, all those guys got fired. But I did have a chance to watch Kevin McNair work. And I brought him into East Carolina later. And Kevin was one of the first people who I basically saw coach force application into the ground, the importance of hip posture, the importance of arm stroke, just the overall importance of body position. And, but he really kind of opened my eyes to a lot of things in relationship to strength that you need to apply force into the ground to propel your hips through the air to give you stride length.
Well, any of this,
yeah,
if you're asking me in my opinion, I can tell you the histrionics of my relationship with field training, speed training, and conditioning, because they all have an evolution. They're all connected. But I got to say, I would defer to you because so much, I was very blessed to be able to hear and try to apply some of the programs that Lawrence Seagraves, who had applied. I was fortunate to actually have Tom Telez in my backyard come over and work with the players and more watch what he was doing with my players, because that wasn't my strongest suit. But I will tell you, some of the best knowledge, some of the best information, I can go to Charlie Francis, I can do the things that I've read and taken a look at. But really, Jeff, this is not because we're here. I got to defer to you that what you shared with me and your manual was so valuable to how I altered what I had been doing in the past as far as training athletes for speed. Because training for conditioning is not training for speed.
Yeah, no doubt.
Conditioning,
no doubt,
is a byproduct.
Yeah.
It's the actual quality of speed is in itself a fitness component that needs to be trained, developed, and improved. And let me give you an example. And I think it was 2003, we coached in the Pro Bowl. And I'm working with the entire team. I don't know a lot of these athletes very well because they come from every team, right?
Right.
And I remember players going through my warm-up. And I still remember a player for the Chicago Bears named Reuben Brown. And I'm so thankful that I got to meet Reuben a couple of days earlier. I had my kids. He had his kids. We met in the pool. We're talking. And so at least I had a relationship with him because he came up to me after the first practice and said, "Coach, I love you. You're a nice guy. You make me sweat more in my warm-up than I normally do in practice in Chicago." That's one extreme.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to go to another one. Jerry Rice. I watched as I taught the players how we went through our pre-practice warm-up, our muscle activation.
Right.
A lot of guys call it stretching. It's not stretching. It's preparing the body for the day's practice.
Right.
And so a lot of ours are very functional and very active. And Jerry Rice he's eyeballing me as I'm doing the activities and showing the athletes what I want them to do for their pre-activation. Very attentive. And yet the next day, I notice he's really not doing some of the things that we were doing for the pre-activation. So I went up to him towards the end of practice, I said, "Jerry, I have so much respect for you as an athlete and what you've been able to accomplish. I just have a question.
yesterday you were so attentive to everything I was doing, but today I did notice you didn't do some of the activities. Did you think they were not beneficial? I want to know.
Right.
And he said, Coach, I love what you showed me. He goes, I'm going to add some of those into my routine. He goes, but the way Coach Fisher runs his practices, you do the warm up after he's already done his special teams walkthrough.
Yeah, gotcha.
Me personally, mm-hmm. I want to be 100% warmed up before the walkthrough.
Okay.
He goes, I've already, this was killing me. He goes, Coach, I've already run 2 miles, went down to the hotel gym and did all of my warm up, including some of the things that you taught me yesterday.
Wow.
He goes, so thank you for improving my program. He goes, but when I hit that field, I want to be 100% ready to run full speed.
Right.
And you wonder why he's so successful.
Incredible.
Yep.
That's great to hear.
Yeah.
That's a great story. I'm glad you told me that. So with regard to speed, you know, we got all these gurus out there now, and I think it's a good thing. And I think that as a profession, we've learned a lot. You know, now some people I think are out there more for the financial end of things possibly, but at the same time, I think the profession has really grown with regard to how to teach speed and put away a lot of the myths. And I thought there were a lot of those out there, particularly some of the ways that some of these athletes were coached during their high school careers. And we'd get them in, you know, at the collegiate level. And of course, one of the main things we had to do was fix them. And a lot of those kids had ran track in high school as well. But I think it's come a long way. And I'm still trying to learn more myself. And I still coach speed, but
well, I will tell you this. Some of your drills, I think some of the things that you shared with me that we put into our program were some of the most beneficial drills. Everything from the hip pops to upper body running, sitting on the field, to the fence drills that you taught us. Those were so practical that I could use with the whole team. But one of the things that I really found in talking to you about speed was your ability as a diagnostic individual, being able to find an individual's weakness. Teaching speed to a large group is one thing, but right. finding a person's weakness, as you shared, giving me some of the cases that you had taken a look at in the past, that's the real ability to coach speed.
No doubt. Yeah, I think the more that you can, and what I used to like to do, and this was many, many years ago, this is when we had the Cowboys, you know, where you would freeze frame and they'd go frame by frame. Mm-hmm. So I think we were one of the first schools that really videoed everyone and just broke it down frame by frame and then basically got them in there, you know, in the office one-on-one and were able to have them study themselves. And I think that really helped us quite a bit. And that was actually a long time ago when we started that. So yeah, good stuff.
Well, for anybody out there is looking for a drill that was maybe a little more unique that we did was teaching a player that's been running for 20 some years. And for them to find value on changing a technique, sometimes can be difficult because they're like, this is the way I've run my whole career. And teaching them that they're wasting energy, that by altering a technique, it'll make them more effective, be able to control the center of gravity, be more an efficient runner, and ultimately make them faster and less fatigued.
Right.
That can be a challenge at times. So often what I would do with an athlete that really was wasting energy, often throwing the hands side to side when they were running and not understanding that A to B running, cheek to pocket, becoming more efficient. when I would identify an athlete that didn't run well, I would have them run sprints or say, well, if you don't think it's important, then you can't use your arms.
Yeah.
Actually have them do half gasses with the rest of the team, but they had to have their hands behind their back.
Gotcha.
And it would be amazing how fast they would realize how much that made them more efficient. And it said, if that would make you more efficient, amazing.
Right.
How much more efficient it would be if you did it really correctly and with the right technique. And that was a cute little drill we would.
That puts me in mind of, I used to run stadium steps with, I'd have the athletes sprint stadium steps with a dowel fully extended behind the ears.
Really?
You know, so you had to use your lower body. You had to think about your lower body. So I thought that was very effective as well. Don't know how much time we got left, but I want to go back here and just talk about the awards that you had, because I mentioned that in the beginning, but NFL Strength and Conditioning Lifetime Achievement Award. So longest, you are the coach who spent the longest time with one franchise in the NFL.
I guess of any position.
Okay.
And any position with the same team consecutive years. I think there's the old line coach at the Patriots. They have had as many years or more than I had with the same team, but he left, went to another team. But I guess I have that record. None of that means anything other than a reflection of, I work for some really good men. I was given a lot of grace. I really was, because there were times very easily I could have been fired, maybe pushed a guy to it. I remember Jerry Glanville. I had a guy named Ira Valentine. I was so angry with him that he missed one of my workouts. The players knew, especially in my younger days, if they missed a workout the next day, they had to work out with me.
Yeah.
I may not always been able to be as strong as some, but I would do more reps and sets than they could even count. And I can remember doing this to this one athlete. And unfortunately, he couldn't play the next day because he was so sore. This was 2 days before a game. And I don't know how many coaches would survive that in today's era. So I was very fortunate to work with. And that's the only reason I ever received
any. You were also NFL Coach of the Year, correct?
Okay. There was none of these
things. Strength Coach of the Year, right?
Yeah. But again, none of those things matter. You know this. And this is for anybody watching. It is a reflection of who you get, the athletes I got to train and the coaches I got to work for. Those are the only reasons I got those recognitions.
Right. Yeah. Well, Coach, we're going to wrap it up here, but I think the last thing, and I'd just like you to just say a few words about, is just, we hear all these things about mental health of athletes. We know of the athletes that we coached, some of whom went by the wayside for various reasons. And for anything from possibly in being involved in drugs or some other issue. But that is one of the big reasons that I started a website and wanted to do this podcast, because those guys that experience those types of challenges and hardships, sometimes I feel like, maybe there's a way that we could have saved some of them. I had two young men that I coached who were shot to death. Think about those guys a lot. So, just from a spiritual standpoint, what are your thoughts there? How can we help people?
Well, I'll start with this. Too often, coaches turn their backs when they see things that they don't think directly affects a player's performance on the field.
Right.
Not realizing that the player, the person inside, is more important than anything they'll ever do for you on the field. And I'll be honest with you, when Steve McNair died, it really rocked me.
Yeah.
And the reason is, we have all challenges. I'm not judging anybody else's life. But when we see someone struggling, maybe going down the wrong path, I think as a coach, as a
true Christian brother, you have an obligation to say something.
Right.
And from that point on, I even talked to several players I would pull aside and say, I'm not judging anything that you're doing. I'm not judging. That's not my right.
Yeah.
I just want to let you know that I see what you're doing.
Right.
You're not invisible. And what you're doing, I have seen have negative effects on other athletes. And so if you think you're being invisible and getting away with something, I think it's my obligation to let you know.
Right.
No, you're not invisible. That's one. The second thing is, I think a coach has a responsibility for what we expect out of an athlete. And we do have expect, and that's everything from performance to relationship, is at the very least, we owe them the love and care that goes beyond just the field.
Right.
I know when I find out to this day that one of my players who I worked with is struggling personally at home, family, it breaks my heart. And I do, I take the time, I try to reach out, I try to find out what's going on. And if it's not me personally, I may contact a player that I know he had a relationship and ask them to reach out. And as far as that goes, let me give you an example. The only time in my entire NFL career that I ever stopped the entire workout to address a situation was when the NFL themselves put out a video talking about the shield, the NFL shield, and how important it is. And I understand that's important, but they had some Hall of Famer players talking about and almost challenging the other players not to tarnish the shield. It's a reflection on them, and it's a reflection on me, and it's a reflection on the whole organization, and you have an obligation. And I remember going to the weight room afterwards, sitting there, putting the players through the workouts and stopping it and saying, guys, we've missed the mark. Mm. You don't play for that shield. Your identity should be in your Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Mm. Your identity should be in your family and friends. It's a career. It is not in a shield.
Yeah.
And if that's what you're playing for, it's going to be hollow. When you realize that you get to use the very gifts that God has given you, it'll be much, much more rewarding because it's a gift you've been given.
Awesome.
And I think the mental stress that athletes have are identified in this saying. Everybody thinks it's hard to get into the NFL. Jeff, it's a lot harder to leave the NFL.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because you're always feeling empty when you're either told your career is over, when an injury happens, even upon retirement.
Right.
You feel that had been your identity, and your identity should be in your Lord and Savior, Christ alone.
I hear that. That helps me in my retirement. So I appreciate those words.
Amen, brother.
Well, I really appreciate it. Can't tell you how much this means to me to be able to spend this time with you and how much it means to our program here. So this is Jeff Connors signing off with Steve Watterson for Absolute Empowerment. God bless, and we'll see you next week. Thanks a lot.
God bless.
You've been listening to Absolute Empowerment with Coach Jeff Connors on The Sports Objective. Join us every Monday night for a new edition of the show. Listen to the show pretty much everywhere podcasts are found. Be sure to follow us on social media at TheSportsOBJ on Twitter and TikTok, at The Sports Objective on Instagram. Like and follow our Facebook page and subscribe to our YouTube channel. As always, we appreciate you listening to the show, and go Pirates!